What's up, Dune fans? Welcome back to the Do Not Enter podcast, where today, Paul's not the only one that's spiced up. I'm your host, Humphrey Hsu, and joining me are my friends and co-hosts, Fillmore John.
What's up, guys?
And Nolan Zhang.
Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back, everyone. And today, we are going over the second half of Chapter 44 of Dune, so slowly but surely making your way to the finish line. Yeah, yep. So otherwise, spring break has just started. So how have y'all spring breaks begun? Anything really fun y'all have been doing to update us on?
Already been a hectic one.
Wow, what's been going on?
Well, today I was practicing driving and I was in a parking lot and then all the gates got closed on me. So I got trapped in a parking lot for a long time.
Oh, did y'all try
that's so unfortunate.
Did y'all have to like call the cops or something or?
Yeah, well, we actually tried not to call the cops at first, and at first we tried getting the wooden boards and like trying to like make a ramp to get out the thing, but then the thing is the wood was just too thin, so it cracked, and then we were like, you know what, screw this, let the cops come. Eventually they did come, but it took a while before they got like the secret like gate code or something to open it back up for us.
Oh, okay, wow.
So, that sounds like something straight out from a movie.
Yeah.
Like you just set up those wooden boards as a ramp and you just go flying over the gate.
Yeah.
Like I saw those in a movie, I was like, yeah.
This will totally work, right? Yep. Crack. Yeah.
Crack. Well, we did have like a fat like wooden beam, so like, you know, like a fat.
Well, even with fat wooden beams, I mean, you've taken physics before, so.
I mean, that's a lot of force of gravity right there.
Yeah, I think you need some metal beams.
Optimistically.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, at least getting on that driving grind, you know, that's pretty fun.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, cool. All right, so let's get into the chapter then. But since there's no epigraph, we're just going to go straight to the quote section. So as usual, Fillmore, you have the first quote.
Okay, so my quote this week is, Gurney, why do you insist that Atreides must kill those they love?
Wow. I mean, that's pretty powerful stuff. I mean, Yeah. So my quote this week goes, quote, my father had an instinct for his friends, Paul said. He gave his love sparingly, but with never an error. His weakness lay in misunderstanding hatred. He thought anyone who hated Harkonnens could not betray him. So, pretty long one, but...
Yeah.
A good one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, so my quote of the week goes, Paul, I want you to do something for me. Choose the course of happiness.
It's one of those... I feel like it's one of those like rom-com scenes, even though it's so, it's so serious in this situation, and you know, there's no romance here, right?
It's just, it's not you, it's me. But I want you to do something for me.
Yeah, and it's just if you take it out of context, it's so I don't know, it's so romantic comedy that it's kind of
choose
funny.
The course of happiness.
Yeah, it's so idealistic, you know.
I wish nothing but the best for you.
I'm gonna die of cringe. All right, let's get started. So we pick up this chapter from where we left off last half of the chapter, and we're talking about Paul's coffee service, which is kind of an interesting thing.
Coffee in town.
Yeah, so it seems coffee service is such a huge thing that we must make some ceremonial cups for it. So Paul has this really fancy cup, and it's a fluted alloy of silver and jasmium. So jasmium isn't really a word, kind of. Well, it kind of is a word, but my Google Doc is like underlining it in red, you know.
Me
so
too.
I just kind of took it as jasmine or something, but jasmine's not. Is it a color? I don't even know.
Yeah, I'm not really sure.
But
wasn't there like a red rock called like jasper or something?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah.
Maybe it's something like that.
Maybe.
It must be more of the flower jasmine.
Yeah. Same.
Yeah. I mean. That too, but I don't know how that would correlate with like an alloy.
Like a cup. Maybe they're just spicing the spice coffee with jasmine or something. You know,
maybe.
Tea leaves. Yep. Yeah, who knows? Fancy stuff, though.
I know. And, well, it looks like Jessica's still dissing Chani after confessing that she loves her, because she says that as long as she lives, Paul will not see his duty, which I find to be quite ironic because he seems to be doing his duty just fine.
Yeah, what's more though, like Jessica demeans Chani to the point of just being like a lowly maid almost, serving coffee for her master. Instead, like Jessica kind of prefers that Paul is married to like a great house or even an imperial family for the prestige. However, what's interesting to me is just that Jessica mentions that all the marriageable princesses are Bene Gesserit trained. And it's just like, wow, is that like a normal training regimen for all the royal house's daughters? Or they like enroll at the Bene Gesserit school? Like, do they get mentored by the Bene Gesserits that the family hire? I don't really understand the process of that.
I mean, maybe not even, I think the Bene Gesserit just insert their own into the big great houses, because the great houses have been so thoroughly infiltrated by the Bene Gesserit that you'll be hard pressed to find a royal house that doesn't have ties to the Bene Gesserit. Maybe since the Bene Gesserit, you know, at the beginning of the book we saw that they're a very politically heavy organization, so they probably tried to infiltrate every single great house that's worth infiltrating, which is kind of why, you know, all the great houses have Bene Gesserits at the very top of the food chain. Right. And then, but Paul is only fit to marry those really great houses. So, kind of, that's what Jessica means, I feel like.
Yeah. And then she keeps bringing up Bene Gesserit, but I think it's weird because Chani is beside Adina, meaning that she definitely has some Bene Gesserit training.
Yeah. And I mean, we'll see later on what Jessica really thinks about Chani as a marriage, like, and how that'll turn out. Right. But I mean, so far, I didn't realize she had such qualms about it. But Jessica clearly states that she doesn't think Chani is good enough and doesn't bring the Atreides enough prestige. So.
Also, despite having grown accustomed to the life among the Fremen as their highly regarded Reverend Mother, Jessica still kind of wishes for a life off of Arrakis in a nice cushy home as a royal consort. I guess, in a way, Jessica's kind of like relapsing in a way. I don't know. All I know is that Herbert writes this desire as something that can never truly go away. No matter how much Jessica's adapted to it, the thought still kind of tugs at the back of her mind and resurfaces at times of reflection, kind of like what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she still hasn't recovered, even though she has such a prominent position within the Fremen. She's not going to be happy with what she has, right? And the fact that she wants to see, you know, Paul's kid primarily because he looks like Leto really just says a lot about the state of her mind right now. It's not really in a good state still. Yeah, it is.
I mean, she did say herself that she'll never get used to the sands of Arrakis. And whenever she finds a connection to her previous life on Caladan, she's just going to relapse.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's harder for her to adapt given that she's a lot older and she's spent more of her life on Caladan, right, than Paul has. So Paul has kind of just jumped to the situation as any 15-year-old would, right, just kind of really quickly adapting. But it's not so quick for Jessica, who's more kind of set in old ways, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we get the reintroduction of Gurney here, and he's on to Jessica in a flash. So he's always been on to Jessica in that he's always thought that Jessica is the traitor, but now he's literally physically on to her, ready to kill her. And it's almost like a jump scare, because even if there isn't a literary jump scare, it kind of scares you because Gurney just kind of blinks and then he's about to stab Jessica. So.
Oh, yeah. He was like a Five Nights at Freddy's animatronic.
Oh, no. It's just suddenly it just pops up on your screen.
Yeah, he literally just jumped out onto her. Wait, that sounded kind of wrong. Well, let me rephrase that. And so he basically attacked her before she could react.
Yeah. That's crazy. I mean, just Gurney not giving anyone any time to do anything.
Yeah.
Yep. Also, kind of remember how a couple of episodes ago, I kind of characterized Gurney Halleck as doubtful and wary. Well, here Jessica also kind of agrees with me. She characterizes Gurney as a killer wary of the voice, wary of every combat stratagem, wary of every trick of death and violence. So Jessica's characterization of Gurney is also wary, but the thing is, this wary isn't necessarily a bad thing, because this wariness as a warrior kind of makes Gurney hard to take down. For he's very, very aware and expecting of every possibility.
Yeah, and especially Jessica is so wary that she, Gurney is so wary of Jessica that she's not allowed to use the voice even. She has to talk in a monotone, which is kind of funny. Imagine the first thing you think of is just talking a robot voice. You know,
hate life.
It's just, please don't kill me, you know, kind of thing. But I mean, since clearly Jessica is in no position to handle this, let's see how Paul handles it.
But although I was sort of confused, because Paul could use the voice on him and he really wouldn't be able to do anything, so I was thinking maybe he's able to react before the voice controls him. But I mean, later in the chapter it basically shows how it rolls out.
It also mentioned a little bit that Gurney has some anti-voice training or something like that. So it probably
Jessica
wouldn't be
actually
as effective. Yeah, that Jessica actually, because, you know, especially Jessica has to make sure that the people in the Atreides' inner circle are not being controlled against their own will, right? So,
right.
So yeah, so kind of a quite ironic thing.
I also find it most intriguing that Gurney kind of himself, instead of killing Jessica outright, wants to force out of her, in a way, her final moments, a whole confession to her own son. Every single time, though, like, it's just not simply enough to just kill a person, but there always seems to be an ulterior motive or like a greater purpose or like a desperate need for the killer to kind of justify their actions. Either way, like, Gurney's need for this kind of gives Jessica and Paul the room to try to gain a greater understanding of like how to convince Gurney to not kill her, of course. And also, like, holistically wise for the book, it gives us a way of like understanding more of how the voice works and how it can be combated by an experienced fighter.
Yeah, indeed. It also helps merge the stories of Gurney and Jessica more thoroughly. I mean, they're on separate pages, and so somehow Herbert needs to reconcile these two storylines.
I really agree with you about how he does this to find justification in his actions, because I think that deep in his heart, he doesn't completely believe that Jessica could have committed such an atrocity and continued living with
her
son.
If also, like, Jessica could be awarded like the best last words, I'd give it to her, because, like, just as before she's killed, she's like thinking these words. So that's it. What irony. Like, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
Like, either way, it's like great to see Jessica's like mental processes still working at top speed, even when she's being held at like knife point. She can still make jokes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
so funny.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, clearly, Gurney has had his own, albeit false, evidence that Jessica is the traitor. So he's even went out and he's bribed for information, which is hard for him to do because he's out here bribing Harkonnen, people who he was literally rescued from Harkonnen's, and now he has to pay them for information. I mean, that must have been really hard for him. So clearly he's been mind and body just totally consumed by this treachery and this rage and this need to get back at whoever did it. So he's just really latching on to Jessica here, who, you know, in his mind is the clear perpetrator of this treachery.
I mean, it's quite understandable that his hatred is this far, considering everything he once valued was taken away from him, just not once but twice now. And first was his own family, and now it's his family and the Atreides. And he's especially bitter this time because he believes it was by someone who he considered to be his family.
Yeah, just like how Hawa also developed a similar like intense hatred, Gurney here also developed his own intense hatred during the times that they spent apart.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is, history tends to repeat itself, and, you know, especially, it's kind of weird, the parallels between Hawa and Gurney. So a little bit of a spoiler, but later on this chapter, Gurney will ask Jessica to kill him and ask Paul to kill him, and Hawat did the same thing. And, you know, right now Hawat and Gurney both have the same mindset that Jessica's a traitor, so we're gonna have literally this exact same scenario happen in the future with Hawat.
Yeah.
You know, and Hawat's gonna jump on Jessica, and we're gonna have the exact same conversation. So a lot of interesting parallels there.
I hope Gurney gets through to him.
Okay, so, like, Paul also kind of, it's kind of weird because he kind of knows everything that's gone on. Even though, like, I thought some of the information was more selective to some parties that were, like, privy to this key information. I mean, I know there's been, like, a massive time skip since, like, last time, but I didn't expect Paul to have, like, piece together the entire puzzle, right? But the thing is, he has. He knows Yue's a traitor, how, like, his imperial conditioning was overridden, and Harkonnen's plan of, like, planting evidence against Jessica to turn Hawa and Gurney upon her. Only problem is, he doesn't have any proof on hand. It's back in, like, what, Tabor Siege, and, like, Gurney right here has Jessica in his arms ready to kill her, so he better pull something out, or else he's not gonna work.
I mean, I'm interested in how they got around the imperial conditioning, though, because our only idea of it was that he was able to break it because of his love for his wife, but there seems to have been an actual method of circumventing the conditioning.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, so, I mean, probably it'll be revealed in some, like, evil speech by the Baron or something like that.
That's so true.
Yeah, one of those gloating things. It's like, do you want to know how I got Yue? And then just Toss and toss.
The laugh expository.
And then Paul's like, no, I don't want to know. And then he just kills the bear.
Hello. That's an anti-climax right there, that's for sure.
Yeah. Breaking norms.
Also, just as we thought we knew how the voice worked, Paul kind of breaks the rule again by imbuing his own monotonic voice with greater power than Jessica's ever seen before. So apparently this is what she calls the Great Control. So that's what Paul has.
What an epic name.
Yeah, I can't tell if this Great Control is an actual voice thing or is it just the monotone he gives is super intimidating. You know, I can't, like, is maybe he's just talking this monotone that just scares everybody. And then so that's like, quote unquote, the voice, but not really, right? And I mean, it just opens more doors, I think, into how the voice could work. You know, is this monotone actually controlling Gurney? Is it not just like the inflections making its way into your consciousness and controlling you? Is there some other work at hand here? Maybe it's just some timbre or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know actually, but I hope we get a definitive answer as to what the voice actually is, because right now we've been just getting these chunks here and there and getting like building up our idea of it. But I kind of want to know like the origins and how it's actually used, because or how it was first used and who learned to use it and who was the original Bene Gesserit, like all these different questions.
Just like, how did they stumble across the voice? Just like someday, like this first Bene Gesserit was just like really like angry at someone. She's like, sit down. It was like, whoa. And it just sat. Whoa,
it just sat. Yeah. Imagine just discovering power like that.
I mean, yeah, just... it might not even be in English. It could be like, siéntense or something.
Yeah, and then it just sits down. Oops. Yeah. But I mean, that is really interesting though. But no, it's probably some long chain of evolution. Even though... I mean, it's like long chain of like evolution, also like genetic modification, probably and stuff like that. As science got more advanced, and
that's
then
true.
Kind of creating
artificial selection.
Yeah, especially how much the Bene Gesserit prizes bloodlines and all of that. You know, it wouldn't be surprising if there's some artificial selection going on here.
Right.
Yeah. Cool. So, I mean, a lot of interesting questions, and later on, especially towards the end, there's even more questions. So stay tuned for that. But I must read some chunks of Paul's monologue here that he tries to convince Gurney that Jessica is not the traitor. And even though I can't actually hear his great control, his words are definitely something to behold. So I'll pick and choose some parts to read out. So here he goes. What you have not done, Paul said, is heard my mother sobbing in the night over her lost Duke. You have not seen her eyes stab flame when she speaks of killing Harkonnens. What you have not done, Paul went on, is remembered the lessons you learned in a Harkonnen slave pit. You speak of pride in my father's friendship. Didn't you learn the difference between Harkonnen and Atreides so that you could smell a Harkonnen trick by the stink they left on it? Didn't you learn that Atreides' loyalty is bought with love while the Harkonnen coin is hate? Couldn't you see through the very nature of this betrayal? The evidence we have is Yue's own message to us admitting his treachery, Paul said. I swear this to you by the love I hold for you, a love I will still hold even after I leave you dead on this floor. My father had an instinct for his friends, Paul said. He gave his love sparingly, but with never an error. His weakness lay in misunderstanding hatred. He thought anyone who hated Harkonnens could not betray him. One of the most terrible moments in a boy's life, Paul said, is when he discovers his father and mother are human beings who share a love that he can never quite taste. It's a loss, an awakening to the fact that the world is there and here and we are in it alone. The moment carries its own truth. You can't evade it. I heard my father when he spoke of my mother. She's not the betrayer, Gurney. So, wow, let's just break this down. I mean, what powerful delivery and what powerful writing by Herbert, I must say.
Mm-hmm. I really agree. And I also really like how Paul differentiates the values of the Atreides here from the Harkonnens, because Atreides' loyalty is bought with love and Harkonnen by loyalty with hate. And he's clarifying this to someone who clearly knows the difference, but like the difference between the two houses. And yet it seems like we're all hearing it again for the first time.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I stuck my quote of the week in there, and it's just really, you know, this whole interplay between love and hate is kind of just like bright and dark that we're so used to seeing. And a lot of people don't like Leto as a Dune character because he's almost like too righteous, if you know what I mean. Because the whole purpose of Dune is to make you kind of question your own morals, your own judgments, and, you know, make a moral compass spin 720 degrees, right? And it just... how the book does that is just it presents characters that are so ambiguously bad and good that you have to draw your own conclusions from that. And a lot of times you draw wrong conclusions, you know, or the characters draw wrong conclusions and you're just screaming at, internally at the characters, or eventually if you find that you drew the wrong conclusion, you're screaming at yourself, how could I have not seen that, right? And that's kind of the beauty of the book. And Leto's trust in others ultimately became his downfall. And even though he vetted his inner circle so thoroughly, he couldn't see past the falsehood of this old adage, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, right? He couldn't understand that someone who hated someone who hated the Harkonnens as much as him could also not like him as a ruler. And at some point, since he's such a good, and I mean good as in, you know, a strong moral compass, since Leto is such a good character, he's hard-pressed to create suspicion from love. You know, it's hard for him to always be evaluating with a critical eye. So after it passes the initial inspection, he just kind of turns a blind eye, right? And that's kind of where the treachery snuck in. And Paul and Jessica really don't seem to have this problem, though. They seem to be more kind of aware, and they're less good of characters, I feel like, and they're always kind of looking not just for the good in others, which of course they do, but they also make some of their own questionable judgments.
Mm-hmm. But I think that also falls within their Bene Gesserit training, because they're able to differentiate between animalistic and humanistic people, I guess. And then I think that differentiation allows them to tell which people are truly loyal and which aren't, which Duke Leto kind of struggled with that because he didn't have this sort of training. Although he had Jessica, it just wasn't enough. He needed his own judgment on top of that, but he just did not have the facility.
Do y'all think the Harkonnens would test his animals in the Gom Jabbar?
They would most likely die in the Gom Jabbar, but I mean...
I was just thinking because, well, if they die, then they test his animals, so...
Right.
Yeah.
Except for maybe, I don't know, maybe some of them might pass because as like a plot twist, but we're not really too sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's just popped in my mind anyway. I was just thinking, you know, since maybe that's like a way to vet people, you know, just use the Gom Jabbar.
That's strange.
Yeah. And also you mentioned like the part about the moment when a boy discovers the love his father and mother share. I found it to be very touching, and I think Paul now understands how heart-wrenching it was for Jessica to lose Leto, especially now that he is a father himself.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. I think this like touching description of Paul's end honestly kind of surprised me in a way, because I never really took Paul to be the type of person who could really feel such a depth of emotion, especially as he became ever more analytical, ever more anxious after adopting his Mentat and Bene Gesserit powers, right? Especially after assuming all his different roles as, like, you know, the Duke's inheritor and, like, the ruler of the Fremen, etc. But really, like, him having just, like, such a, just like a son who lost his father moment was really kind of tear-jerking in a way. It really reveals how much, like, Leto's death has impacted him, and maybe this was, like, kind of the understanding that Paul was seeking when he was, like, when he mentioned that, like, oh, like, I relate to Chani because we both lost our fathers, you know? Maybe, like, this was the type of thing that he was able to find in Chani that he couldn't find in anyone else.
Yeah, and he never really got over Leto either, I suppose. Just, you know, we always rat on Jessica for always being stuck in the past, but clearly, you know, Paul's has some of his own inner demons too. Yeah, I mean, Paul, I think, has just been dealing with it in a different way. He's just been letting his duty overtake him, so consume him so much, and especially with the jihad and everything, he's just been letting that kind of take over his thoughts so he doesn't have time to think about the past, right? But, and I mean, even Paul back, you know, at the very end of book one, you know, all those many moons ago when we went over that chapter, Paul was, you know, crying in the tent and everything, you know, he's still human. And I mean, and just this way he deals with it, his coping style is just how he deals with it. And Paul really just spilled it all here, you know. Even he cried his emotions out at the end of book one, but here now he's just speaking his emotions, and he laid it bare for the reader and for Gurney and Jessica. And now we just know the depth of the pain he faces too, even though he doesn't show it on the outside.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He's really just like holding Paul's it all words. In. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, like, Paul's words are, like, super moving, even in the situation where his mother's being held hostage by an old friend who he thought he could trust wholeheartedly. Paul's still able to say that he loves Gurney, you know, even after Gurney maybe kills his mom. I think like this type of love is quite beautiful and special. And it's like, I'm a little tad bit jealous of this love. You know?
It's so kind of honest. It's one of the more pure forms of love that we've seen in this book. You know, there's no, it's unconditional, which is rare. Because everything in such a like world fending for survival, everything must be conditional to an extent. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's always, there's been so many betrayals and just people changing their minds last second, just switching to the other side. But I mean, here we see an actual example of a real bond. Like we've seen it between Chani and Paul. Mm-hmm. Well, Jessica and Paul as well. But I mean, here we go, another example of it. And it's just so rare in this world because, I mean, the Harkonnens exist.
Yeah, and it's just, there's just so much hate, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just surprising that, you know, Paul and Jessica and still, so they just have so much empathy for each other, given that, you know, Paul stated that Jessica was his worst enemy and Jessica has been proving of Paul's actions. So kind of another form of love here that we see, even though they have their own misunderstandings, there's nothing really stronger than a mother-son bond, right?
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Bene Gesserits have more empathy than the average human? Because technically they're more human.
And they also understand better. They understand human emotion better. So, I mean, I guess that could go both ways. Like, if you understand better, I suppose you empathize better, but that also makes you more, like, rational about it. And we know, like, human emotion is not the most rational thing, right? So,
right.
So I don't know. It could go both ways. It's not a science. Yeah, but... So, I mean, and Jessica really continues after this this spiel by Paul and just continues by blessing Paul almost, saying that she's been wrong and that she's been manipulating him to satisfy her own Bene Gesserit ideals. And this basically confirms what Paul has thought all along about his terrible purpose and his mother's influence in that, right? But it seems now that Jessica has moved to oppose her own ideals in order to find happiness for Paul, you know, which is a start. And, mm-hmm. I mean, I just... But also something small I didn't realize was I didn't realize that Chani and Paul weren't married yet. You know, for some reason, I always thought they married in like the time skip between books 2 and 3.
Nope, I guess not.
Yeah.
Because I think her relationship with, or Chani's relationship with Paul is similar to what Jessica had with Leto. And I'm pretty sure that's what we were talking about a couple episodes back. We're like, why is Jessica so hard on Chani even though she's in a similar situation as she was with Leto? Mm-hmm. And... But I think it's also good to see that Jessica finally realizes what she was doing and tells Paul to break away from his fate. And hopefully it's not too late for him to avoid it.
Mm-hmm. This basically leads into my quote of the week, which is, Paul, I want you to do something for me. Choose the course of happiness. So I really chose this quote because so many of us really just grow up chasing careers, not because it pleases us, but because we know it's safe. And because we, our parents, peers, even teachers, no, it's safe. Everybody, societally, people pressure all of us to choose the careers that's basically guaranteed to make some money some way, even if we fail. And really, just like, it made such an impact when I read this, because today, especially after watching like the Dead Poets Society, this quote really just hits only ever harder. In the movie, there's no spoilers, by the way, so you can still watch it afterwards. There's like this famous quote that goes, I went to the woods because I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to put to root all that was not life, and not when I came to die discover that I had not lived. And basically, like, that sums up like why people should like not live without regrets, you know, because of that simple human urging to find purpose in life and to live a fulfilling life. The phrase that's most like prominent throughout the entire movie, carpe diem, or Latin for seize the day, is really what like I took away from like that movie and from reading that quote. Like,
yeah, so I mean, it's just really, you know, whether you pursue your duty, or as Paul has been doing, you know, everything he's doing recently is for duty, but, you know, or whether you pursue your own ideals, right? Whether you kind of just let yourself loose and kind of see where that takes you. And there's, and oftentimes, as with life, there's just no right or wrong. They just have to kind of play along and find out, right? And see what happens. Yeah, but it really is a beautiful quote, even though it's, I feel like it seems a little bit overused. I can't place where I've heard it before, but I mean, it doesn't make it any less true. Yeah, so I mean, again, you know, as with a lot, we see the same thing play out with Gurney. There's this, it's just this matter of honor, and Gurney would just rather die as he believes his treachery was too much. However, since worse didn't come to worst, I think we can all be happy that Gurney will wholeheartedly support what's left of the Atreides now. He doesn't have any qualms about a traitor in their midst or anything like that, so now he can full focus on destroying the Harkonnens, which is really what we're all here for, right? I mean, yeah, so, and Jessica, diplomatic as usual, diffuses the situation with music, so as a musician, I heartily approve of that. So, I mean, I diffuse myself with music, so.
I agree, and I really like the mature way Jessica took Gurney's apology, which is coincidentally my quote for this week, because she said, "Gurney, why do you insist that Atreides must kill those they love?" Which, I mean, I thought that was very fitting for the situation, because, I mean, even though Gurney is older than Jessica, I'm assuming, I'm pretty sure they stated that earlier in the book, it seems like Gurney is like the younger child here who kind of went on a fit, but now Jessica's just forgiving him for just going on this rampage, even though he didn't really need to.
It's even more Jessica funny still took with it, like, everything.
Yeah, she still took it like very maturely. Like, she didn't freak out. She didn't like say, "Gurney, you should go punish yourself by doing 100 push-ups in the corner or something." She's just like, "Oh, can you play some music for us to like lighten the mood?"
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so just like with everything going on ever since like Stilgar and now Gurney, I think there's just really like something about dying after making a mistake, right? Especially with Hawatu. Mm-hmm. Personally, I don't think I'll ever be moved to feel such a manner of, to like, should die for someone. But again, things are different now in the modern world. In the past world, maybe, than whatever Doom was written, right? So, like, now we don't really live for a cause. We live in a kind of capitalistic society where we'd probably flip our bosses off on our way out of their office after getting fired.
You know? Honestly, so, like, yeah, no shame nowadays. No honor. Yeah, that's chivalry is dead kind of thing.
Well, I mean, some of these bosses deserve it, though.
Oh, I mean, that's honestly, for real. That's for anti-work where we at. But, like, no, I don't support that necessarily. But yeah, I mean, it's just this whole, I feel like over time, honor has just decreased, you know, and now we're kind of at a low, but especially in this world, it's kind of you know, as we've mentioned earlier before in the podcast, it's kind of like it's like pseudo futuristic in that a lot of things are still like in the past, right? Like knives and stuff, you know, you would expect them to be fighting with like laser knives or something, I don't know, but
like a rail gun or something.
Yeah, but here they're just still using literal Chris knives and whatever, right? And I don't know, so just this whole honor code thing, I guess, is just kind of a something that draws from that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I'm also really happy that both Jessica and Paul have found a different method of atonement for Gurney, and like, what better way than to put your heart and soul into song and rip some awe-inspiring tunes on the ballad set? So like, it is a little jarring for Gurney, of course. I'm sure this show of acceptance, though, will help him understand that the Atreides don't just see him as a tool, like as a right-hand tool to be discarded when he fails to perform correctly, like what he just did, but rather they still see him as a person, really, just like ready to handle his flaws on top of all his triumphs. And with that, Gurney is able to sing the beautiful words. Let me read it to y'all. "Orchards and vineyards and full-breasted Horus, a cup overflowing before me. Why do I babble of battles and mountains reduced to dust? Why do I feel these tears? Heavens stand open and scatter their riches. My hands need but gather their wealth. Why do I think of an ambush and poison and molten cup? Why do I feel my years? Love's arms beckon with their naked delights and Eden's promised ecstasies. Why do I remember the scars, dream of old transgressions, and why do I sleep with fears?" Wow. So that last parting verse really just like calls on the theme of the novel Doom, right? Like, fear is the mind killer. Just like beautiful lyrics on Gurney's part, really conveying all his nerves and constant fears, but at the same time still never really betraying his love and loyalty he contains for the Atreides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, again, Gurney is a scarred character with all of the stuff that, I mean, I'm a scarred reader after reading this book, you know, and it's just, there's so much kind of trauma going on. I can't imagine how the characters would feel, and especially, you know, them talking about the old battles and feeling tears and all of that, you know, and feeling the years even with all of the riches of heaven and all of that, and, you know, talking about the old transgressions, right? It's just, even with kind of a great, well, I mean, they're not in a great state, but they're vastly better off than, you know, Gurney just barely escaping with his life, and also Paul and Jessica crashing Ornithopter in the middle of the desert, right? They're vastly better off than where they were before. And now, you know, they still, but that their past really still haunts them. Yeah, so really like with beautiful poetry.
Yeah. I feel like when Gurney sings the song, he talks about his past, and we know how terrible his past is. And I know that if it's any other person, they probably would have given up at this point. But here's Gurney still fighting, still training these soldiers, still singing on his baliset. And he's just able to continue on. And it just, he's just so respectful. I don't know. He deserves all the respect that he can get. Because, I mean,
the mark not many of Gurney people can continue determined.
Yeah, he's so determined. He just doesn't stop. Mm-hmm. I don't know. He's like an actual machine.
Yeah, for really. He's had so much bad things happen to him and everything. Yeah, so, and it just keeps going, going, going. So that definitely does very deserving of respect.
Yep.
Yeah, so kind of moving away from all of this, you know, really, I mean, I wouldn't like kind of sentimental stuff, right? And so we get kind of back to technicalities, and it's so weird. There's this small maker that the Fremen just contain here, and they just trap with water ditches. And, you know, it's weird because they trap with water ditches. I'm imagining it's like a moat of sorts, but why is the water of all things poisonous for sandworms? I thought water was crucial to all life.
I mean, that's very interesting because that means they don't really need water to drink, and that would explain how they managed to get so large in a waterless world. But I think it's weird that water is poisonous to them, because maybe their body can only intake acidic levels of like the liquid, and water is neutral, so it's like a poison to them. I don't really know.
Maybe like they have like a high internal pH, and I mean a low internal pH, and water is too basic, or vice versa.
I don't even know myself, because like sandworms just truly defy logic for organisms in our world, because at least according to my level of biology knowledge, every organism depends on water, and you know, they receive it through various means, drinking, absorption, or from the food that they eat. So sandworms really are just perplexing to me.
Yeah, it's weird, you know, because people just get large, right? I mean, like, especially a lot of animals, their body mass is just a lot of it. It's just water. So the fact that sandworms can get
the waterway
so big, you know, what, they just have shells or something, I don't know, that make them so big. Do they drink sulfuric acid every day or something like that? I don't know. Yeah, so
would not recommend doing that.
Yeah, that do not try that at home. Very acidic. pH of zero or less
before we get sued.
And also the worms emerge from something called a maker vector. So what do y'all think this is? Is it just some spawning machine, like one of those Minecraft spawners? You get a sandworm egg and you put it in the spawner and start spawning little sandworms. I don't know.
You try to sleep next to it, you may not sleep, there's monsters nearby.
One of the oldest things, but that's still so funny. Yeah,
I mean, it sounds like a nest of some sort, or maybe like an incubator. That's my guess.
I think incubator makes sense, yeah.
When I read it, it just really drew a blank in my head, because I was really trying to conceptualize some sort of like sandworm being pregnant and like giving birth, but like, I don't know, I just couldn't see it, you know, like nothing made sense in my head, so yeah. I still have no idea what maker vector is.
I mean, I wouldn't say the sandworms are mammals, though. They're probably reptilian.
That's true.
So they probably lay eggs of some sort, right? But
reptilian? Aren't they just insects?
I don't know. I mean,
worms, guys.
Yeah, what are worms? Honestly, I wouldn't.
They
know.
Could have their own genus and species.
Yeah. So I don't even know. Let's create a new phylum for these guys. New kingdom. Yeah, honestly,
we're going to back to my sixth grade biology. I'm just
revealing how little I remember from biology and environmental science. It's like how little I remember from that.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to become a biologist.
Oh, yeah, all my teachers are just like shaking their heads right now. I'm just like, man, you know, you aced that test. Where were you? Where are you now in 6 years, right? It's just forgot it all. Yeah, but
yeah.
I mean, we're gonna continue with all this, you know, science that we've all forgotten. Yeah. So continuing along those lines, I mean, we've gotten the idea that drowning a maker produces the water of life. But how come this maker can create some substance that only a reverend mother can change? So this is just some sort of chemical reaction, because when Jessica changed the water, she was imagining reactions, right? She was imagining like moving the atoms and whatever. So why can't science just change the water? You know, we can manipulate right. atoms and stuff, right? So does the worm just, I don't know, exhale some hallucinogenic into the water when it dies? So I mean, there's just so many questions here. It's so complicated. What's going on with these worms? What chemicals do they have that make it so that make it so special? And why can only the Reverend Mother change it when there's so much science around them?
Yeah, also like this in that regard, like does Gaius Hellemoheum also have access to this water of life, or is it like unique only to the Fremen people? But then we also slowly begin to understand also like the physical dependence of the Fremen to Arrakis's nature, but also to like the sandworms. Truly seeing like why the sandworms are really known as makers by the Fremen, because they make the water of life that allows them to transcend into this interconnected community, to feel like one with nature, almost, to feel like connected.
Yeah,
that's... to answer your question about does Gaius Hellemoheum have access to this water, I would say no, because, well, I mean, most likely she doesn't, and she's not really. I would be surprised if she was aware of the way to get the poison, mm-hmm. or the way to kill the worm and get the special poison. Yeah,
and I mean,
yeah.
Clearly,
if I knew about it, I'd yeah. hope on it.
Oh yeah, and I mean, clearly the Bene Gesserit have, you know, they have their influences in Fremen society very clearly with the missionary and all of that, right? But I mean, it's just they're. I feel like they're kind of like a individual sect or of sorts, you know. They're not yep. directly tied to the Bene Gesserit. So I mean, even that Reverend Mother, I think it was Romalo. I don't think, you know, she necessarily would have had connections with the great Reverend Mother Mohiam, right? And in this case, yeah, you know, yeah. I'm sure Mohiam isn't aware of anything going on at Arrakis at this point, past just very little information. Since the Fremen are so secretive anyway, they can't afford word of them going out, because we don't know where Mohiam's allegiances lie.
Oh, so like how there's different sects of religion, just like in our world, there's like different yeah. sects of Christianity, like
yeah,
Greek
like
Orthodox, and
yeah, like you Roman wouldn't Catholic. You wouldn't, you know, say the Eastern Orthodox and the Roman Catholics would constantly talk to each other and share information and all that, and right. especially you wouldn't assume the Eastern Orthodox and the Western Protestants to talk about that. So I mean, I feel like they're just like kind of like their own isolated thing. Like maybe yeah, initially they have Bene Gesserit roots, but now they've kind of evolved into something that's a lot like bigger, I guess.
Yeah,
they're basically like a secretive cult inside their society. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, true. Yeah, they have their own thing going on. We don't know, and we don't need to know. Yeah, yeah. So we end the chapter on a bit of a cliffhanger, I must say. Appal's visions of the future are stalling with the spice tolerance. So I wonder if he'll try to, like, I don't know, consume more spice and eventually OD on it, if that's even possible. I don't even know if it's possible to overdose on spice. You know, from what I can tell, it's just,
I guess we'll never
yeah.
know.
I mean, yeah, well, we might know. Who knows?
We might.
It's just something, the punishment is just shoving spice down your throat. And then it's just, you're literally eating money, but then you're dying. Yeah, so,
I mean. Shove $1 billion down your throat.
It's just like, you want $1 billion? Here, take it. It's just.
It's a Mr. Beast video.
Where has Mr. Beast gone? Mr. Beast is way different from how I remember it a few years ago. I was just shoving billions of dollars down people's throats. Anyway, but I mean, Paul also plans to drown the worm, right? Which is apparently a Kwisatz Haderach test. So I wonder what is the real test? So at first, my initial impression was that drowning the worm is the test. Like he has to go in sumo wrestler style and roll up his sleeves and wade into the water and just like put the head down like a baptism, except for with murderous intent, you know?
Just goes in there with the loincloth trying to wrestle it in the water.
Yeah, it's just a whole like spectacle. It's Paul versus the worm. Yeah, tickets on sale for $25. But what I think is like Paul, he's gonna try to test whether he possesses the ability to change the water, just like a Reverend Mother would be able to. So maybe the Kasatz Hadarach has some ability that, you know, transcends even Reverend Mother abilities. And I mean, either way, things are looking quite unbalanced for Paul in the near future. Some, it's all teeter-tottering still, even though, you know, and with, especially with his visions kind of dimming, which is weird because we haven't even seen much of his visions and they're already going away. Yeah. So
he didn't even see Gurney and like what happened. Like he just didn't see that happen.
Yeah, his visions. Yeah, I guess he just really didn't have any information or any hint whatsoever that Jessica would have been the traitor. Otherwise, it would have factored into his calculations.
I mean, we also know that only the true Kwisatz Haderach can look both into the past and the future. And he's already done both of these. So I don't know why it isn't really guaranteed that he will pass the test. Maybe it's still a difficult process even with his powers, but I mean, it's not super clear why. I'm assuming it's because of his gender, but I guess we'll find out next chapter.
I also just really do wonder if this entire idea of taking this water of life was ran by Jessica first, because we know what Jessica gets when it comes to her son.
Yeah, I mean, Jessica's just kind of pushing her own agenda onto her son. It's like the ultimate politician, just political agenda.
Yeah, I mean, she did say that she wanted Paul to go on his own path. So
I mean, it's almost a little, I don't know, it feels a little too sincere. It was kind of like the circumstances forced that out of her compared to her actually believing. Maybe it was just a moment of weakness or a moment of emotion, right? But I mean, I can't judge Jessica just based off of that, especially we haven't had any evidence to contradict that she didn't mean that. Right. Since she said that, but we'll just have to wait and see what her motives really are, you know, talking about Paul and how, whether, you know, she wants to control Paul and his marriage with Shani, but also his leadership over the Fremen. So all these things, just stay tuned and we'll eventually get to those. And but on that note, I believe that concludes the discussion for this episode of the Do Not Enter podcast. Make sure to read halfway through chapter 45, ending at, quote, Jessica gasped. And tune in next time when we discuss it. As always, thanks to all of you listeners for being patient with us and being interested in our thoughts. Follow us on Instagram at DoNotEnter, Reddit @DoNotEnter, Twitter at DoNotEnter, and email us at DoNotEnter@gmail.com. That is DUNENOTENTER@gmail.com. Please contact us with questions, feedback, or ideas. Man, it seems like my mic broke. It's not playing that word. Yeah, I think I cut out there. Sorry. Oh, wow. Well, I already said it, so... All right, give us a review on iTunes or Spotify. It only takes a few seconds of your time, so you have to go and make an account and then go to our show and then click the 5-star button, because you know that's the only one that exists. And also leave a nice review or two if you're so inclined. The reasons for that are twofold. One, it helps get our podcast up the charts, to get it out to a wider variety of listeners. But on a more personal note, it lets us know that we're doing a good job and motivates us to keep creating content for you guys. So any support or feedback would be very much appreciated. Otherwise, have a great week, and we will see you all back very soon.
See you guys.
Bye, guys.